Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Working Triathlete podcast. Today, we are speaking with Ron Chalasta. So Ron is a swim coach. He's the owner of SeaStar Swim School in Hendersonville, Tennessee, which has been in business for the last 29 years. He is an ASCA Level 4 certified coach. He was the swim coach at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and coached at Woodside Aquatics in San Francisco, where he coached numerous USA top 16 swimmers and high school All-Americans. He coached the four-time US national champ, Lysel Colbison. And he also has a very impressive background as a swimmer. He won the Big Shoulders 2.5K swim in Chicago, and also won his age group in races at Del Mar Days, Samana, Nautica, and the Castaic Lake Swim. In the mid-80s through early 90s, he partnered with Mike Bottom, traveling extensively through the U.S., teaching clinics, and he also taught clinics for the national teams of New Zealand, Korea, Indonesia, and Guatemala. So a very experienced, very capable swimmer and swim coach, and we're really excited to have him on. So Ron, thanks for joining. And to start, can you talk a little bit more about your background in the sport, how you got into swimming and coaching?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me today. Probably like most aspiring athletes, the first time I ever jumped into a pool, I knew that swimming was for me. Through the high school years, I swam at Hinsdale Central in Chicago. Back in the day, Hinsdale was called Titletown USA. It was just an elite school, pretty much more in the minor sports, but our swim program, 13 years in a row, the state champions. Got into coaching shortly after high school. I broke my shoulder my senior year of high school, had a long rehab with that, and started coaching age group as an assistant on that coaching staff. From there, I ended up landing my first, I would say, serious coaching job at Calvin College, which is a D3 school in Grand Rapids. Had a great success there with their men's team. Eventually made my way to the Bay Area, and for 16 years had Woodside Aquatics, and that was kind of like the main, coaching position that I've had throughout my career.
Got it. And now I know you work with many athletes, pure swimmers who are extremely competent and fast, and you also work with triathletes, and obviously many of our listeners are triathletes, and I'm sure there are some differences maybe you see with adult learned swimmers or athletes who get into swimming through triathlon or new swimmers. So, what are some of the differences you see, between, say, triathletes learning how to swim and maybe pure swimmers, maybe as it relates to technique or perspectives on training?
Okay. Well, first of all, I love working with adult athletes, and especially people who are new to the sport of swimming. I'm sure as working triathlete coaches, you have a lot of inquiry right now, new people that want to come into training. Swimming always seems to be that little anomaly. Like, I would say most triathletes, it's their least enjoyable of the disciplines. And so each year I always get the question, what is my launching off point? And I don't care if an athlete is a beginner or an elite level athlete, but I believe that the three key ingredients to swimming successfully are airflow, balance, and control. Mm-hmm. So what do I mean by that? Is airflow, a lot of people, they come in and they run a 2-hour, 45-minute marathon, So it's not that they're deconditioned or that they're out of shape, but they don't know how to flow their air. So imagine if you were running out on the road and you had a big trash can liner over your head, and about every fourth stride, you could open it up and get a breath. Okay. That's what swimming is. Our head is underneath a suffocating liquid, and I have to know when to flow air out and when to breathe in. So airflow. Second thing is balance. If we take that same athlete who's maybe an elite marathon runner and they want to get into triathlon, and they can't swim 25 yards without being winded. A lot of it is because those people, they're lean and mean. They have 4% body fat and they begin to sink. So balance, how can I relax in the water? How can I, instead of trying to muscle my way across the pool, relaxing so I have a higher ability to float higher on the water and move forward. And then finally, control. I can't control anything. So I can't even really learn technique if I don't know how to breathe. If all I'm worried about is not suffocating or drowning, there is no way that I can work on technique, field drills, even begin training, anything like that. So those would be my three important ingredients for somebody who's making their first attempts.
And so we think about airflow. It's interesting because it seems like those three items, airflow, balance, and control, the ability to relax is really important in what you're saying. And one thing that I think is worth talking about as it relates to that is this concept of body position. And so relaxing can actually enhance body position, right?
Yes. Yes. So two things related to that. When you watch the Olympics, for example, and you see Katie Ledecky or Michael Phelps, they're always standing up on the edge and they're shaking their arms and shaking their legs. So that's not to scare the woman in the other lane or scare the guy like, hey, look at how strong I am. That's about relaxing muscle. So when I'm relaxed, I will float higher in the water. Okay. Body position, a lot of that has to do with our head position. In any sport that we do, the head governs the body. So wherever my head is pointing, that's the direction my body will go in. If I tend to bury my head when I'm swimming, I don't know if you could see my arm here, but if my head goes down, my feet are going to go up. And then I'm collecting a lot of water on top of my back, and I have to move that forward with me. If my head is up, my legs go down. And then it's like running into a brick wall. I create a lot of resistance through my lower body. So finding that sweet spot, every sport has their sweet spot. When Serena Williams hits the ball, when it pops off of her racket, it makes that popping sound. That's the sweet spot. So for a swimmer, you know, finding that ideal balance, that would be very important to your forward progress.
This concept of drag is really important. And are there any drills? So if a new swimmer comes in or somebody who has really poor body position, is there an approach that you like to take? Maybe it's individual, but is there an approach that generally you like to take to try to help athletes relax and improve body position?
Yes, that's a good question. One of the things that I love to do with more my entry-level swimmers is recommend that they buy a pair of fins. So training fins that they're different from scuba fins, you know, that a scuba fin is a stiff rubber on the boot. And, you know, you could damage your ankle, you know, by using it. But Speedo Tier, you know, they put out a product. It's a softer fin. It's a training fin. And those can be used for so many different purposes. But at the beginning level, when you kick with a fin on, number one, it helps your people who come from a running background, they tend to have really stiff ankles and they will poke at the water, which almost, if you put them on a kickboard, makes them go backwards. Okay. When you put the fin on, it corrects that pattern of how the ankle should move and how we go. But because you're pushing a bigger volume of water, you sit up higher on the water and you have less resistance. So the fin can actually teach us how to develop a better body position. It can help us to relax because we have, it's easier to breathe. We have better airflow. And I use them all the time. Many critics will argue, oh, you're cheating if you're wearing a pair of fins. But as coaches and looking at applied physiology, you know, my heart doesn't know the difference if I'm swimming, riding a bicycle, or running. Aerobic is aerobic, right? So if I'm wearing a pair of fins and it's enhancing my ability to have better balance and airflow, then I think it's a win, for that entry-level person.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. It is definitely the case, even especially doing drills. Many drills require a propulsive kick. And I definitely see that, you know, many triathletes, they just can't point their toes. And if you can't generate any propulsion with your kick, you can't really do the drills because you're just going to kind of float there and sink in. And
it's so true. Yeah. So when you think about runners, cyclists as well, when they come in, they know how to use the lower body, right? That's what drives them. So if all my large muscles, the glutes, the quads, the hamstrings, if I'm firing those legs and I'm kicking furiously to stay afloat, it just shoots my heart rate way up, almost like into a threshold level. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that I could even enjoy swimming or begin to establish a better body position when I'm like just frantic in the water.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to mention too, is it seems like a lot of new swimmers, there's no difference in pace when it comes with, you know, versus like their easy pace, you know, zone one, zone two to their threshold pace. And, you know, without the feel of the water, they can't really tell the difference in how fast they're going. So can you speak a little bit about that? Is that part of just relaxing a little bit in the water or just body position in general as well?
Right. I think that a lot of that, so most of us, when we're taught to swim, it's all about our arms, you know, just paddle, 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 move the arm. Because if I don't have continuous movement, I'm going to sink. And, you know, as much as we hate to use the drown word, you know, if I sink to the bottom and drown, you know, I'm more in a survival mode. So with that idea of relaxing, and a swimmer can do this, whether they use fins or no fins, what I like to try to talk with my athletes about is, can you swim across the pool? How quiet can you be, almost like sneaking up on an enemy? And how few strokes can you take? So quiet, that means when I'm putting my hand out in front, when I'm placing my hand on the water, if I hit the water really hard, it creates turbulence. It creates a splash, and all that water is around my head. I'm also trapping air with my hand, so I can't even get a hold of the water. I've created turbulence and it makes it difficult to breathe. Therefore, I can't relax. So if I can put my hand out in front real quiet and go slow as possible, I like to say, can you imagine your body being light as a feather? Okay. To a non-swimmer, that's hard to imagine. But even if you try it, you know, starting out with 4 to 8 strokes to get going, how easy and how quiet can I swim across the pool?
Yeah. And to do that, you obviously need that balance and control that you're talking about. And if you don't have that balance and control, you're not going to swim fast. I should have mentioned earlier, but January is swim month for working triathlete. So all of the athletes we work with, we really try to focus on the swim a little bit more this month. And one big error we see is athletes. Well, there are a few, but like you talked about before, this concept of fighting to get across the pool, and they just sort of fight the water, you know, kick in, flailing about a lot. They're focusing on their watch and hitting lap, and they're not engaged with what they're doing. They're not trying to feel as light as a feather. They're not thinking about proprioception, or they're just kind of fighting it rather than working with the water. And a big focus is having athletes kind of slow down their stroke and kind of become one with the water, for lack of better word. But you know, have you seen triathletes, when we think about, like, say, using watches in the pool? I know that triathletes often overly rely on that, and they're not engaged with the water. They're somewhere else, just thinking about hitting the prescribed paces or times. You know, how do you think about the pace clock or structuring workouts like that?
All right. So that's a great question. You know, I'm old as dirt, Conrad. So, you know, I've graduated from the sundial to the pace clock. And my people, my triathletes specifically, they will argue about the pace clock all day long, because everybody, you know, they want to hit their watch. So we're kind of at an impasse. They've helped me, I've got to say, you know, come into the modern era, and technology can be very helpful. I get it. I think the issue is a lot of triathletes who, let's say, they're in the Strava community. And so they're reporting workouts to all their friends and, you know, their Strava community, whether it's just a public forum or it's, you know, their friend group. They're very concerned about every workout. If I'm not holding a certain pace, let's say your pace is 140 per 100, and I hit that on a Tuesday, but then I come back on a Thursday and I can barely hold 145. Okay. And then just mentally, I just watch people crumble, you know, week after week. And extrapolate that out, if I'm not improving that a month from now, people get really discouraged with that. Yeah. So, yeah. I think it's good to be able to look at your pace, but I can tell you, when you look at our elite, and I know these are swimming purists, they're not pushing a button just because of reaction time. It's not accurate. And so to understand the pace clock and how to read the pace clock, I think is critical, because we have to face it. 90% of our training is done in the pool, right? So the better that I can become at reading a pace clock and understanding what is the interval time and what is my repeat time, that's where we're going to make the gains. And, you know, my people, they'll argue. I have a thing, like, every now and again, I call it ticked off Tuesday, because it frustrates me as a coach when they're pushing the button and they don't know the send off time, or if they're on a really tight set, or maybe I want them to have 5 seconds, you know, rest between their distance, or put them to failure. There's not time to push the button. So I make them put all their watches on the kickboard. I'm like, then they argue, Ron, if it's not on Strava, it didn't happen. You guys hear that a lot, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think there, you have to have a good balance, and I think the watch can help us record volume and heart rates and all of that type of thing. But to have an awareness of the pace clock is critical.
When it comes to, it sort of is a good segue into technology, and I know that you've been working a little bit with the EO. Essentially, it's a power meter for swimming.
Yes.
What can you talk a little bit more about that, what that is, and what kind of insights you're seeing?
Yes, the EO has ignited my mind. It's given me kicked me in the butt a little bit about using tech, because when I watch you as coaches, you're always doing your test sets. I see it where you can evaluate people on the bike. You're evaluating on the run. In swimming, we haven't really had a very good, method to measure. So it's very cool to see the EO, their handsets. They look like wristwatches that you put on your hands, and they measure, they can correct your stroke. They measure propulsion, which is a big deal. They measure where you lose your feel, where you lose hold of the water within your stroke. So from a coaching perspective, I could stand on top of John Huber in a workout, and I could watch him go back and forth all day and say, "John, you have a beautiful freestyle stroke, but I don't have an awareness of how he's holding water or perhaps where he's losing power in that stroke." So the thing that's cool about EO is it feeds back right away, whether you're using a monitor or to your phone, and it can show you exactly where you're less propulsive. Through the different vectors that it uses, it can also measure, technical difficulties that you're having, whether that's crossing over, whether, you're not on the push phase of your stroke, pushing all the way back, and it can analyze those type of things. And I think that's very helpful for people who don't have access to maybe a master's team or a coach who can, be eyeballing, all the work that they're doing. So.
I have a quick question about that power meter. So I know I've seen a lot about it already, and I look at different athletes and their stroke style. Have you seen any interesting cases where someone might have like a power imbalance from one arm to the other, especially if like they're a higher level swimmer?
Yes. And it's fascinating, Derek. When Mike was here for the first clinic that we did with the EO, I actually took a lesson from him the day before our clinic. And it was really embarrassing on my left arm. Now I've broken my left shoulder. I shouldn't make excuses, but we all do, okay? And I've had a broken left elbow. But I got in and my left arm was only 39% propulsive. And I'm just thinking, man, this is horrible. I think I'm feeling the water. My stroke rate was good, the whole thing. But within 10 minutes of him helping me make some corrections, it went from 39% up to 47%. And that was my little aha moment. Like, this is can be very helpful, especially for people that have swam high school or college, and they look really efficient in the water. But because we've swam forever, we have no idea how we're holding the water.
Yeah, and real quick, I was able to get a session in with the EO at the last swim clinic, and one of the things that I really enjoyed is like you talk about efficiency in the water and how important that is. And so you can identify early vertical forearm and see if they're pulling the water. You talk about propulsion, but one of the things that was kind of shown to me was like dead spots in your stroke, kind of like on a cycling power meter. If you have dual sided, you can see the efficiency of your pedal stroke. You can't really ever see like where a dead spot is, or it, like as if you're looking at someone in the water. But being able to go in and see like, oh, this like right here when you go into the water, you're actually lifting your arm up instead of getting that high early vertical forearm. I think that was one of the more important things that I took away from it, is that like it's like we can identify where those little dead spots are and like coach athletes in order to be more efficient, which is the name of the game in swimming.
Yeah, that's a good point. And a lot of athletes, so we should talk about the clinic. So last month, Ron and Mike Bottom put on a clinic locally just outside of Nashville, and many working triathletes attended. And there were many epiphanies there, and many of the athletes on the team left really excited with new things to work on and sort of epiphanies that, you know, the things that clicked. Another one thing that a couple athletes really liked was the cue of kind of having your elbow pop up. I know a big, often when it comes to getting that hand into the catch position, the old saying is pretend you're reaching over a barrel, you know, you're keeping that elbow high and reaching down. But I think, I don't know which coach said it, but I know a couple athletes were like, man, what somebody said, just pop your elbow up. And what that essentially does is it drives the forearm down, gets you in a good catch position so that you can actually apply power backwards. So, you know, that's just one benefit of the clinic. And there is another clinic coming up that I definitely would love for all of the local working triathletes to attend it. And what is the date of that?
It's next Friday and Friday night and Saturday. So the 19th and 20th of January. And all of the info is on our master's website, which is mtscmasters.com. Okay. It's fun to work with Mike. He's recently retired from the University of Michigan. As you know, I mean, he's my friend, but in my opinion, he's probably the most talented swim coach on the planet. When you figure he had the two guys, he Anthony Irving and Gary Hall, they tied for the Olympic gold medal. Mm-hmm. You know, couldn't have been a more better outcome for a coach who enjoys both of those athletes. But, you know, even in the open water, I think early on, the first sanctioned open water championship by U.S. swimming, you know, his athletes placed one and two there. So, you know, coaching five Olympians, he's very dynamic, very clear, straightforward communicator. And it's really fun to work with him. It's just hearing him talk is motivation in itself. The other thing, and John might agree with that, he had some different kind of paddles that he's brought. They're not even on the market yet. And he has like a neighbor of his, they do them on a 3D printer. And so I think when I tried, it was just really helpful, you know, in helping keep your arm in the correct position when you're using them. They're a little weird at first, but you know, once you try them and swim a couple laps, it makes sense. It helps you connect.
Got it. So those paddles, what do they do specifically? They just sort of force your like wrist and forearm to remain in a good position, or what is unique about them?
Exactly. They make you, if you're swimming inefficiently, they're going to fly right off your hand, you know? So they make you pull in the proper pattern. Now this time, because we're going to be addressing open water and triathletes, we're going to focus a little bit more on shoulder driven freestyle. And so Derek, that might help a little bit answer your question. You know, like what is the difference between pool swimming and open water swimmers? I believe that, you know, really swimming is swimming. You know, a lot of people have concerns about deep water. Well, we float the same in the deep end as we do in the shallow end.
Very true.
One of the biggest, so I'm where I'm sitting right now, I live on a lake. And so we have an incredible opportunity. We have a huge open water curriculum that we do in the spring and summertime. But really a huge concern for people is when I look at that expansive body of water, if the waters, I don't know the depth, I can't see the bottom, there's a little chop to the water, my vision might be bad. Maybe I don't see, you know, and I don't have prescription goggles. And so I get this anxiety and the panic, you know, that sets in, and that's very real. You can swim amazing in the pool, but then, you know, when you face that big, wide open body of water, there's a lot of different variables, you know, that we have to consider. I just had the opportunity. I just vacationed in Quintana Roo, Mexico. So that was like 2 weeks ago. And it was so much fun. My youngest son, he's a rescue swimmer in the Coast Guard. And so we were training together one day, and there were like these 4 feet swells coming in. There was a cross current and an undertow. And so just to be able to get out past where the waves were breaking, he taught me this little technique of just grabbing onto the bottom of the ocean floor so that you're not like, if you had to swim straight out and hit a buoy, by grabbing onto the ocean floor, when that cross current comes, you're not going to get swept 5 yards, further away from your line. Mm-hmm. So just different things like that. Looking at stroke rate. If I'm looking at waves that come in, one of the trickiest places, believe it or not, that I've ever swam is on Ohio Street Beach in Chicago. And I've swam from Alcatraz 3 different times, but man, that water, there's like a place where boats come in and it's like a washing machine. It just spins you around. So having an understanding of the course, but also looking at sets of waves that come in. So if I have to, for people, this would be people more swimming, maybe, somewhere Santa Cruz or, Northern California like that. Can I time those waves so I know when they're going to break in case I have to duck dive under a wave to get through it? How many strokes does it take me to get from wave to wave before I have to dive under? Instead of just getting pommeled and I get set back, I get thrown back a little bit. So I'm not swimming, I feel like I'm going on a treadmill. I'm able to make forward progress. So as we get into this clinic, we're going to be looking at ways that we could be more shoulder driven so that when conditions are rough, we're able to hold on to the water better. And again, I guess the best thing parallel I could draw is like, I'm not running on a I'm not swimming on a treadmill. I'm actually making forward progress.
Yeah, all of this is very interesting stuff. I know that I would categorize her as certainly the top swimmer in triathlon, Lucy Charles. She has an extremely high stroke rate.
Yes. I think it's
pretty darn shoulder driven. I think that especially athletes who don't have a propulsive kick, if you can make it so that you increase your stroke rate, I think that there's a benefit there. You're sort of exchanging some energy that you would be using in the legs, kind of expending it with the upper body. But when we think about a more shoulder driven stroke, I'm curious what your thoughts are, maybe as it relates to fitness. I mean, do you think more fitness is required, to execute a shoulder driven stroke well? Because it isn't just about having the same stroke as one, say, a normal, like a hip driven stroke and just accelerating. I guess, what are some of the differences between, a shoulder driven stroke that is efficient at a high stroke rate versus, like a 30 stroke per minute type stroke?
Well, I think, to answer this one, I would believe, and whether you're in the pool or in the open water, because again, we're talking about levels of fitness, mm-hmm. but I believe that swimmers have to be careful. I call it the five fingers. Okay. So I need to be concerned about speed, power, strength, flexibility, and endurance. And that doesn't matter if I'm a sprint triathlete or if I'm an Ironman. Those are things that I have to factor in. So when you ask about fitness, those are the most important. Unfortunately, flexibility is the one that we ignore the most. It's just, who wants to spend time stretching? A lot of people, we have enough on our plate, especially as, most people, they're professional adults. They only have X amount of time. So fitness is important, but speed and power, there's a big difference between using get out speed. Maybe speed as we're working with it in the pool would be more assisted swims. Using bands, it could be using fins. And you know, working on my stroke rate, short bursts of speed with a lot of rest in between. Power, I do a lot of sets where, you know, we're using resistance. And again, whether that's bands, sometimes we put, you know, t-shirts, a rip tee on people, paddles, fins, but they're always swimming against resistance. And there'll be a portion underwater where I'm trying to put them into oxygen debt so that they get the feeling of what it's like to simulate, you know, that race at high speed. You know, I think power and speed have to be sprinkled into the sets that you're doing. And that's all throughout the year. A lot of people, they hibernate, you know, in the off season, but I think you can always be doing maintenance. And even in the maintenance phase, I want to be considering all of those aspects.
Makes sense. So, you know, maybe this is a good segue into workout types. In a typical week, how do you think about, you know, structuring training for, say, I know you coach some really solid triathletes at the Master Swim group that you run. How do you think about, did you think about, you know, training for them on a weekly basis? Like you try to get in, you know, a key intensity swim or, you know, a speed or power focus swim on certain days. It's, how do you think about structuring training for triathletes over a, say a macro cycle?
Okay. So definitely my yearly plan includes a training cycle. And so right now, because we're just starting a new year, most of my athletes that I have, their key race is going to be in May. Mm-hmm. And that kind of coincides with Masters Nationals. And so that's really fun because I don't have people training, you know, 25 hours a week. So, you know, everybody's like, I always want to be tapered, you know, for my big race. That's the word that I always hear. And I think to myself, there's no way I can taper you yeah. when I have 3 hours a week with you, because you have to put in your cycling, you have to put in your running. So what I try to do for, you know, in my training cycle is anytime that they come to the pool to see me. So if they're with me Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, for example, they will have a key workout. They don't even have to think about it. They don't have to worry about it. But when you come, you want to be rested when you come to the pool, because that's going to be your key day. Now, from working triathlete perspective, as you're laying out people's weekly plan, monthly plan. So if, you know, John knows that, oh, okay, this athlete A is coming for a key workout on Tuesday. If I'm asking them to run later that evening, it needs to be like aerobic one or two. It needs to be a little bit more chill because they just put out in the morning workout. So I try to address that with my athletes is like, if you're going to come to my Saturday morning workout, don't get up and do, you know, a 3 hour ride or whatever, you know, at high intensity, because you're not going to make it. You're going to end up failing. And then you're going to leave feeling defeated when you come out of the workout. I want my people to leave the pool feeling good about what they did every day. Okay. Because it's not only just the physical aspect. We have to think about, I call it the mind gym. What's how I got to be working on my mind. I have to work on positive self-talk. I have to work on being race ready. So coming back to that training cycle, if I'm integrating all of the five things, ingredients that we do throughout that season, and I'm applying that, I want them to come to the start line rested and race ready. I don't know if that makes sense or if that answered the question. And at the same time, triathletes have taught me a lot. in coaching swimmers. There was a season, most of you could, a season of the triathlon back in the 80s, if you recall the Bud Light series. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where it all got started. They didn't even allow wetsuits. Okay. So people would wear their Speedo for the whole race. Well, how was it that Mike Pigg and Scott Tinley and these guys could come out week after week swimming at a high level, swimming at race pace or better? Okay. There was never like, well, I have an A race and a B race, and this race doesn't matter as much. I have to be fired up and ready to go because there was money. That's when money came into the sport. So they were winning races and getting paid, right? Well, they were always shaved. So I took that. I thought, I'm going to try this at the pool because in, you know, the sport of swimming, it's always like, here's my big shave and taper meet, right? Where I've got to go fast, okay? So I tried it with, I had a group of 13 and 14 year old boys that were talented, and I convinced them, we're going to shave, you're going to be shaved all year. And we're going to see if we can start the season swimming really fast, whether it's making a junior national time or, you know, making a far Western cut, whatever. And then at the end of the season, can we be just as fast or slightly better? You know, and so that really worked, and it really spoke to me like, okay, if I keep firing these systems and have my athletes race ready instead of putting all this volume in there, you know, I'm sure all of you as athletes have had the experience, man, I got to drive. I'm so tired today. I want to turn around halfway to the pool and go home and just forget it because you're just so beat. You know, I want to see, can we be firing on all systems, on all pistons as we go through the season? And, you know, I think definitely that there's a way to do that, you know, and have people more race ready than tapered.
Yeah, I think, yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in there. And there, I think, you know, we think about block training and this idea that you can, once you reach a high level of fitness, you can kind of, you know, maintain it for quite a while. And the traditional periodization model where you spend, you know, months just doing a lot of volume, very little intensity, we're kind of past that at this point, especially at the high level. You know, we know that, you know, a more balanced kind of distribution, certainly having blocks where you focus on maybe one energy system, so to speak, more than the other, that to achieve certain adaptations can be wise. But it sounds like there's something to be said by executing a balanced training plan where you're working on speed, power, etc. So year round, more or less. And there's this just chronic cardio, this bunch of volume where you're just tired all the time, maybe not, isn't the best approach. You need a good balanced kind of distribution, especially, I guess that also makes sense for triathletes who, you know, maybe they don't have the luxury of swimming 30K a week for a few months to lay, you know, a so-called aerobic base.
Right.
But
right. And I think that what it comes down to, and I think that the challenge for US tri coaches, for me as a swim coach, I want my people to train smart so that they could race fast. Okay. So if I'm working a 40-hour work week and I still, you know, I have a couple guys like that right now, and they're doing like ridiculous things in the tri world, but if I can train in a way where I'm laying out my weekly workouts and they're very strategic how I lay them out, and it's, you know, the economy of time, because maybe I'm married, I have kids, you know, whatever, I'm, you know, there's a lot on my plate. I want to be able to trust my fitness. If I train smart, I can show up at the start line and I can trust my fitness to the point I don't have to be worried. You know, ooh, there's the anxiety. It's really, and it's interesting to me to go to the start line of a race. And you've all heard this chatter, from people, right? Oh my gosh, there wasn't enough toilet paper in the Port-a-John, or somebody bumped me in the workout, or oh, I didn't eat right last night. And there's all like these excuses going on, you know, before the gun ever goes off, like you're sabotaged. So all of those things, if we plan for those and we're prepared for them, this is where the mind gym comes into play. If my mind is set right and I trust my fitness, and that's the job of you guys, is to put together these plans where people trust it. And when they go out, they're going to have incredible results.
Definitely.
That's the fun of the training cycle.
It is. You got to put in the work in training, sort of train like you race, and be ready for it. But, you know, I also liked what you said about, you know, this concept of showing up to key workouts fairly well rested. And I think that for a lot of triathletes, you know, the swim is not an afterthought, but they probably think about it. They spend less time doing it, certainly,
right,
than cycling and running. And they don't take the key workouts as seriously, but certainly I think, and you talked about once a week having that really key workout that you protect. And, you know, maybe you're going to be swimming a little bit longer that day, or it's going to be a higher load swim. I think there's something to be said for that. And you kind of prepare for that, like you prepare for a race, and you take it seriously. And on that day, you are a pure swimmer. And
right.
Maybe you're not wearing your watch that day.
Right. But even if you are, I think also is just, what do I, as the athlete, want to get out of this season? Am I the person that wants to just simply complete a race? Okay. There's a lot to be said for that. That's, again, that's just a level of measurement of fitness or setting a goal. Others who want to get out of the middle of the pack and perhaps start making the podium, right? Or being in the top of their age group. Unfortunately, when you're racing against the people at the top, you've got to be getting out of the water pretty much, you know, with that lead pack. And the reason being is, you know, whatever, I don't know, it's a 10K. I'm not as familiar with the running, but, you know, if our 10Ks are both 36 minutes, you know, at the end, if somebody has a 2-minute jump on me and they beat me off the bike, I can't reel them in. You know, at that level, pretty much everybody's parallel. So even though swimming is the smallest percentage of the race, I still have to be in striking distance. And what I see with a lot of my people is it doesn't take much, you know, to get there. If you're just persistent and consistent in your work and you're doing the right kind of work, the gains are incredible. It a lot of times it makes me laugh, Conrad, because I'll have people and one of them is your guys. I'm not even going to say the guy's name, but he did an Ironman. And the week before we were doing pace work. Okay, to be race ready. And he came in and another guy, they were both in the same race. And they're like, we'll be happy to hold 2 minutes per 100. And I'm thinking, are you out of your mind? We just did pace 100s holding 115. You think you're going to go 2 minutes in the race, you know? And of course they went to the race and they far exceeded their expectations. But that's the fun part, is that when you learn a behavior, okay, so when you're paying attention to the clock and paying attention to your pace, you're going to learn a behavior. And that can be done through test sets where I'm doing measurements, you know, every other month or once a month, and I can actually see improvement. And that's the fun part, because, oh, I improved, but it didn't hurt that much to grow. It hurts. But it didn't, yeah, I wasn't on the crash cart, so to speak.
Yeah, that it's the swim is becoming so important at the pro level, obviously, and even to win one's age group, it requires a good swim. Gone are the days where an Uber cyclist can catch you know, the front pack of swimmers. I mean, you can say honestly at this point, at any say championship level race, the winner is going to come out of the front swim pack. It's just right. Kind of how it goes now. And I know with the pro athletes we work with, it's a massive focus. The swim, you have to be a rocket in the water if you want to be in contention. And the stakes are higher now. I mean, you have to be good at all three sports, obviously, but now more than ever, for sure. So
Conrad, let's hit on, this might be a fun thing for your working tri people, mm-hmm. where they can feedback to you as coaches. Let's give them a January test set. Are you open to that?
Absolutely.
Okay. John, Derek, would this be kind of fun?
I love it.
Okay. So this, I don't care what level you are, okay, is let's just start, because it's the beginning of the year, 10 50s. Okay. So they do a warm up prior to swimming their 10 50s. So let's say at the end of the warm up, heart rate's elevated to 120. Okay, now we're going to administer this test set. And just to keep it really simple for the pace clock, okay, we're sending off, we're going to go 10 50s on every 1 minute. Let's go 80% perceived effort. And whatever that is, each athlete, it will be different. So let's say if you're holding 50 seconds, 50 seconds, 50, 50, 50 for all 10 50s. At the end of that set, take your heart rate and let's see how quickly it goes. So every 30 second increment, take your heart rate and see how quick do you recover back to the 120 where you started. Okay. That's a very simple test for people to do. As you go, maybe you do that January and February and March. So in January, my send-off time was 1 minute. In February, because I have a little bit more base behind me, can I do a send-off of 55 or 50 seconds? And now I'm trying to hold whether it's 45, 45, 45. So I'm maintaining that steady pace, okay? And then how quickly do I recover? And then do that 1 month later, drop 5 seconds again off the send-off time. Can I still hold my pace and recover quicker? So what people are learning, so their fitness, hopefully their fitness is improving, but they're learning to hold their pace on a shorter rest. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if I started at a minute, and we'll just go, I started at a minute, I held 45. I dropped down to 55 seconds, I still held 45 per 50. Now I dropped down to 50 seconds and I still was able to hold 45. Where that translates when I go to the open water, I have developed an internal monitor. I've learned a behavior. I know what it feels like to hold that fast pace with less rest, and I realize it's not going to kill me.
I love that. I like this because it's measuring something probably a little bit more relevant than like a best average set or, you know, like a critical swim speed test, because you're measuring sort of like more or less a sub threshold, or maybe it's a round threshold, 80%. So you're recommending the pacing be, like you said, 80%. Is that, you know, kind of close to like 1,000 meter or 1500 meter race pace in the water?
Whatever your race pace is, you want to simulate your race pace, because that's how we're going to gain confidence. Is if I can measure that and wow, I like, look at what I was able to do in 3 months and I'm only dropping 5 seconds. Well, I guess that is a lot of time, but I'm dropping five off of my send-off time. But man, I was able to maintain that. That's what it's going to feel like when I go into my race.
Yeah, I like that. And integrating, I think it's rare to integrate heart rate into swimming, but it is something that should be done for sure. I mean, it's how you measure stress and progress. But yeah, this is a good one. I like this test. I think it's definitely worthwhile, and I'm gonna prescribe it, and it'll be fun to track progress.
Well, that's exciting. That way, guys, I can have said I've contributed a little bit to the working tri group.
Yeah, I like it.
So that's a lot of fun. But so that's a good, I think, a good January launching off point for working tri and swimming. You know, I think we covered a lot of territory today in our time together. And it's exciting. I'm excited to, you know, I'll be excited to hear your feedback, how your people are going. You know, hopefully our Nashville crowd, we could get together and do a little bit of testing as well over the months ahead. I have a real nice 1500 meter set that I love doing personally. That would be really fun to apply to your people.
Yeah, I think it'll be athletes will definitely improve. They improved from the first clinic, and I'm excited about this one coming up not too long. So I guess just to remind athletes how to sign up for the clinic, or even to get in touch with you, what is the website again?
Okay, it's mtscmasters.com.
Perfect. Then we will include that in the notes, the podcast notes, when we post it. But thanks for coming on, Ron. This was fun, and I think that athletes are gonna take away a lot of good nuggets of wisdom, and maybe we'll do this again. We'll think of another topic and hop on and chat.
All right. Well, best to you guys and to your athletes. It's fun to be at the start of something new in a new year, and best wishes for success.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Bye-bye.
Bye.